Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC Studios, I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast. It's Monday, March 20th. It was just another weekend in the world, wasn't it? Since Friday's show, we learned that Vladimir Putin is being charged with a crime, and Donald Trump says he will be too. Putin was charged with war crimes by the International Criminal Court, if you haven't heard. And if we can believe Trump on this one, he says he will be indicted by the Manhattan DA in the Stormy Daniels hush money case this week. He would be the first president or former president ever charged with a crime and is calling on people to protest, much like he did before January 6th. These two developments can almost make the fact that some banks are going under and the implications for the economy seem like not the biggest Monday morning headline. But let's talk about all three, and maybe then some, with Connecticut Congressman Jim Himes, relevant to all of these stories as a member of both the House Intelligence Committee and the House Financial Services Committee. Financial Services will hold his first hearing on the bank failures this week. Congressman Himes, for those of you who don't know him, is a Democrat whose district begins just over the Westchester line from New York and covers most of Fairfield County there and a little of New Haven County. His bio page notes a whole bunch of Metro North stations that bring commuters into Manhattan in his district. Congressman, thanks for coming on at a consequential moment. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian. Thank you for having me.
With your Financial Services Committee hat on, let's start with the banks and the broader economy. Do you think we've seen the last of the bank failures in this current wave?
I don't know if we've seen the last of the failures. You know, there are a few other banks that share some uncomfortable things in common with Silicon Valley, First Republic, Signature, and that is a very high percentage of uninsured deposits, right? And, you know, people are acting rationally now. They're saying, oh my goodness, I've got well more than the $250,000 insured amount at this bank. I should take those deposits and put them elsewhere. And that, of course, creates pressure. And if there's enough of that activity, you get what's known as a run. So, you know, I do think that the regulators acted rapidly in concert with the president and the Treasury Secretary. And it does seem like this is not going to grow into something cataclysmic, but I think it would be a little bit too audacious to say that we're completely out of the woods at this point.
This kind of thing wasn't supposed to happen after the Dodd-Frank banking reform law following the bank failures of the 2008 financial crisis, as you know. Here's a clip of Senator Elizabeth Warren, who's a hawk on these kinds of things, on CBS Face the Nation yesterday, saying some of the ways she thinks the federal government reopened the door to this kind of risk.
Starting back in 2016 or so, these multi-billion dollar banks that like SVB, in fact, Gary Becker, the CEO of SVB, came to Washington and kept saying, lighten the regulations on us. We're just like tiny little banks, so ease up on the regulations. Donald Trump then ran for president promising he would ease up on the regulations on these multi-billion dollar banks. He then was elected president and he put in a lot of regulators who eased up on banking regulations. Trump then went to Congress and he said, let's ease up even more, and with the help of both parties, passed laws to roll back on regulations and open the door to easing up even more. Then Jerome Powell, the chairman of the Fed, stepped up and took a flamethrower to the regulations.
Senator Elizabeth Warren on Face the Nation blaming the CEO of Silicon Valley Bank, Donald Trump as president, and Fed Chairman Jerome Powell. How much do you agree with Senator Warren there on that timeline?
Well, I think she's using very colorful language and speaking with a degree of certainty that nobody has. She's not wrong that in 2018, a bill passed which differentiated between the monster banks, the Citibanks and the JP Morgans, the truly systemically important banks, and the next level down. You know, she talks about multi-billion dollar banks. And they are, in fact, multi-billion dollar banks, but they're a small fraction of the size of the JP Morgans and the Citibanks. you know, the Federal Reserve is working right now on an after action report about what happened at Silicon Valley Bank. You obviously had irresponsible behavior on the part of depositors, who in many instances had, you know, hundreds of times more on deposit than was guaranteed by the FDIC. It certainly looks like there was a basic risk management failure inside the bank. They just got caught off guard by banking 101, which is when interest rates are rising, the value of your bond portfolio goes down. And it does seem that there may have been slowness or maybe even a lack of attention at the San Francisco Federal Reserve. So I think I'm not surprised that Senator Warren is saying that this is about a piece of legislation that passed in 2018, and she's blaming it on Donald Trump. You know, the reality is that that bill that passed was passed with pretty strong bipartisan support. I just think it's a little early to say. And the other thing I would point out, Brian, is you said it wasn't supposed to happen after 2008. It will happen. We're never going to rid the banking system of the occasional bank failure. There have been failing banks for two centuries now. The work that was done in Dodd-Frank after 2008, 2009, of course, held up pretty well, because what's happening right now really bears almost no relationship to what happened in 2009, when you had banks with just incredibly toxic securities on their balance sheets. Here we had a very narrow and specific set of causes, which created a scary moment, but not one that looks anything like what we lived through in 2009 or 2010.
Senator Warren, though, says Jerome Powell has two jobs as Fed chairman and has failed at both regulation and interest rates. Now, we know Warren has opposed the interest rates going up as risking workers' jobs unnecessarily, the wrong way to fight inflation, in her opinion, as well as not regulating the banks well enough, in her opinion. How much do you agree or disagree regarding Jerome Powell?
Well, so, you know, the story has yet to be told on whether the Federal Reserve is going to adequately wrestle inflation down. That is their job. You know, the Fed has a dual mandate. She's absolutely right that one of the things the Fed does is regulation. And again, I think we do need to unpack whether the San Francisco Federal Reserve Bank was asleep at the switch with respect to what was going on at Silicon Valley Bank. But on the inflationary thing, it's a little too early to say that he's failed on that. It is fair to say that the Fed probably kept interest rates too low too long. And then in response to really pretty dramatic inflation, and again, I represent people just as Senator Warren does, who come home from the grocery store and say, oh my God, I cannot believe what inflation has done to my budget. It is Jerome Powell's job to address that. And he's done that with the one tool he has at his disposal, which is raising interest rates. Senator Warren doesn't like that for all the reasons that we understand. It makes mortgage rates go up. It runs the risk of cooling the economy, which in some ways is the point of monetary policy. But the one conclusion I can give you, Brian, is it's too early to say, because inflation is still higher than we want it to be. And you know, if Powell succeeds in getting it down, in relatively short order, without a major dislocation in our economy, without creating a recession, which he has not yet done, then I think, you know, if he brings inflation down without a recession, that will be the definition of success. But it's a little too early to say for certain.
So do you, I guess, unlike Senator Warren, have confidence in Jerome Powell to lead us out of this if he contributed to getting us into it?
Well, you know, let me step back from that question. One of the key foundations of a stable economy is independent monetary policy. That means that people like me don't get to run the monetary policy. And there's a very good reason for that, right? And there's lots of countries that get it wrong, where politicians get to lower rates going into an election or, you know, mess with monetary policy. So I'm hesitant to answer the question of what I think about Jay Powell's running of monetary policy. I will tell you this. It's hard to escape the conclusion that rates were too low for too long. I mean, for decades, bankers and others got used to zero interest rates. And that was probably kept too low for too long. Whether Jay Powell has steered monetary policy to do what he must do, which is defeat inflation, and did it with a soft landing or a hard landing, again, it's way too early to tell. So far, so good, right? The economy is still very strong out there. And rates are nowhere near where they were the last time the Fed tried to really wrestle inflation down in the early 1980s, where rates went into double digits. So again, it's just too early to tell.
And the Fed will consider interest rates again this week. Would you like to see them go up again to fight inflation, stay the same, or go down maybe to ease pressure on the banks?
You keep trying to get me to violate that axiom, which is that politicians really shouldn't advise on independent monetary policy. I will tell you this. I think it's an interesting moment because, you know, based on what we were just talking about, right, you never really know where the next crash is going to come from. So it was mortgage and toxic mortgage securities in 2008. This time it was people piling into deposits, you know, unguaranteed deposits, and probably some foolish risk management at Silicon Valley Bank. You never really know where the next banking problem is going to come from. You'll never solve them entirely. Again, we've seen bank failures over two centuries. The idea that all of a sudden it's going to stop is, I think, not accurate. I do think it's an interesting moment, though, because an awful lot of people are experiencing something they've never experienced before, which is high interest rates. And it might make sense with that as a motivation for the Fed to say, oh, you know, let's let people really learn from what happened to the Silicon Valley balance sheet with high rates before we continue cranking it up. But again, it's really important that people like me stay out of advising on monetary policy.
Were you at the hearing as a member of the Financial Services Committee that Senator Warren was referring to in the clip? I don't know if it was before your committee or somewhere else, where Silicon Valley Bank CEO Becker testified that he wanted Congress to roll back some of the regulations on the riskiness of their investments?
So Senator Warren is exactly right. And I remember the period in which the mid-sized banks, there was both testimony and there was lots of lobbying where they were saying, guys, we are not systemically dangerous the way a Citibank or a JP Morgan is. And that led to the passage of this legislation. And again, we'll pull that apart. Over time, we'll come to learn whether that legislation, which did lighten some of the obligations of these medium-sized banks, had something to do with Silicon Valley. It's a little early to tell. But no, it was a full-on lobbying effort. And I think the lesson to be drawn there was, and frankly, at the time, I mean, I'll admit to this, I thought, yeah, there is a difference between a $50 billion bank and a $500 billion bank. And I thought at the time that therefore there is less systemic risk. And what I missed and what many people missed was that just because a $50 billion bank can't do what Lehman Brothers or Bear Stearns did in 2008, they have this other mechanism that we saw in play 2 weeks ago. There's this other mechanism whereby they could create systemic risk. So it's a moment for the humility that comes from knowing that you will almost never see the bullet that's going to get you this time if you're just obsessed on what happened last time. Yeah. And that's why right out of the box, I said, are we ever going to stop bank failures entirely? No, because there will always be a new twist that creates some problem. And what you hope is, you hope that the end of the story here is that a couple of banks fail, but there's no dislocation to the broader financial system. That's actually, as uncomfortable as the week may be, that's actually a certainly far better outcome than we saw in 2009, where, you know, people lost, you know, their homes and their jobs, et cetera.
And the New York-based bank that failed, Signature Bank, I've read that Barney Frank himself, co-author of Dodd-Frank, former congressman, liberal Democrat from Massachusetts, is on their board. So are you scratching your head, if that's the case, over how the co-author of the Keep the Banks from Untenable Risks law did not see the risk his own company was taking?
Yeah, no. And I was actually in some communication with Barney. We're good friends. We served together for a long time. There is an irony to that. I would also say that Barney is a legislator. He's not a regulator. So I wouldn't necessarily expect that he would be the one that would identify, you know, a deficit in tier one capital inside the bank. But anyway, he has a theory that this also had a little something to do with crypto in the case of Signature and First Republic. I haven't talked to him in detail about it, but I think that's also worth unpacking a little bit.
In our last 5 minutes, I'm going to ask you to switch hats from Financial Services Committee member to House Intelligence Committee member. And my question is, does the committee have a role in preventing political violence like was not prevented by good enough intelligence, apparently, on January 6th, now that Trump is again summoning his supporters like he did then? You always want to respect the vital right in our democracy to protest, including protest someone's arrest if it happens. I'm sure we have to agree on that first, by all means. And, you know, but we know from the past few years and from the FBI statistics that right-wing political violence is our biggest terrorism threat these days. And Trump, after all, was impeached for inciting the January 6th riot. So what's the Intelligence Committee's role, if any, as we anticipate Trump's possible arrest and his calls to his supporters to take to the streets?
Yeah, well, Brian, as a purely technical matter, the Intelligence Committee is outward looking. We look at foreign intelligence. We don't look at the what is more of a law enforcement issue around intelligence, around violent protests, that sort of thing. But the broader point is exactly right. You know, one of the things you need to do when there is a threat of political violence is you need to make sure that people understand what's about to happen far better than they did on January 6th when I was stuck in the chamber because of a brutal and violent insurrection. So yes, you know, FBI police forces need to make sure that they have a pretty good sense of what's about to happen and that they've got the assets deployed to stop what happened on January 6th. The larger issue, though, Brian, and I mean, this is truly a horrifying thing. Number one, that an ex-president continues to stoke the possibility of violence. Number two, that that's rooted in the belief that he is not subject to the laws. Anytime somebody tries to hold Donald Trump accountable, he paints it as a corrupt, fake news, you know, hoax. And thirdly, and most horrifyingly, if you look at the statistics out there, and you're right, the vast bulk of violence out there is right wing, often white nationalist violence of the variety that we saw in Charlottesville. It is we have come to a horrifying place where more, I think, than in three or four generations, more Americans believe that violence is sometimes okay in our system. We certainly saw that on January 6th. We certainly see that online and in the chat rooms and stuff. And I don't know that government can fix that. I think community leaders, fathers and mothers, priests and rabbis, you know, need to pull us back from that brink, even in the face of the incitement that we hear from Donald Trump. But as a society, if we come to believe that that violence is okay, we've taken a huge step towards losing our democracy.
Also, as a member of the Intelligence Committee, today is the 20th anniversary, as you know, of the start of the Iraq War, a war the U.S. started, I think it's fair to say, based on faulty intelligence that Iraq's leader had weapons of mass destruction and links to al-Qaeda, both wrong, as U.S. intelligence officials later admitted. Have we learned anything that will stop us from making such a mistake again?
I was thinking about that this morning, Brian. You know, there's all these retrospectives where you sort of come to understand that the case was always flimsy for weapons of mass destruction, and yet sort of a mania. And I wasn't in politics at the time, so I didn't see it up close and personal, but there was almost this mania that took over, that Democrats and Republicans, left and right, agreed that the right thing to do was to invade Iraq, which of course turns out to be probably the single biggest strategic mistake the United States has made, you know, certainly since Vietnam. You know, empowering the Iranians, devastating the Iraqi people and the country to a point where groups like ISIS and al-Qaeda really, really flourished. And I think here's the lesson for me. I already hear the drums of war on the horizon with respect to China. And if you look at the study of conflict, a lot of wars get started because people get into this mania that I think seized the country prior to the Iraq War. Or mistakes get made. I mean, the story of World War I is the story of a series of catastrophic errors that wound up with millions of people dead. And the lesson for me, I'd like to unpack it better, but the lesson for me is let's diagnose that. And when people are making extremely almost violent statements with respect to China, which, by the way, if you thought the Iraq War was tough, wait till you see what a war with China could look like. Not even to mention the, you know, commercial interrelationships, the $700 billion in trade we do. Let's take a deep breath. Let's learn from the mania that seized the United States prior to the Iraq War and try not to get into that headspace again.
Connecticut Congressman Jim Himes, Democrat from Fairfield and a little of New Haven County. Thank you very much for joining us today. I appreciate the conversation.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at wnyc.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.